underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In February of 1974, Patty Hearst, the 19-year-old granddaughter of the wealthy newspaper publisher William Randolph Hearst, was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army, a small armed revolutionary group. 2 months after her abduction, questions concerning Hearst's ties to her abductors arose after Hearst declared her allegiance to the SLA. She denounced her family and was seen carrying an automatic weapon during an SLA bank robbery. Newspapers published a photograph of the heiress carrying a weapon and posing in front of the SLA flag. Jeffrey Toobin is a New Yorker staff writer and is a senior legal analyst for CNN. Toobin's new book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst, which revisits the famous kidnapping and the ongoing question of Hearst's motivations and loyalty in the 19 months that followed her abduction. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jeffrey Toobin back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you here.
Hi, Joe.
Very nice to have you back on the program and very nice to have read this book. It's a fascinating look at a case. And you make this point, and I found this surprising, and I realize that it surprised you as well, is that given that there has been so much time, this was a major case in the 70s, some three decades have passed with really little have being written about the Patty Hearst case.
It's true. You know, my route to this story was even a peculiar one. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker about 3 years ago about a jail in Baltimore that was taken over by a gang called the Black Gorilla Family. And I got interested in the history of the Black Gorilla Family, which was founded in the California's Soledad prison by a famous prisoner named George Jackson in the early 70s. And I got interested in sort of the prison activism of the 70s, which was a big part of the counterculture. And that led me to the Symbionese Liberation Army, which also came out of the California prisons. And I went to my editor at Doubleday and was telling him this story. And he said, well, what about Patty Hearst as a subject? And I said, oh, my God, there must be a million books. And he said, well, go check. And it turns out they're not. And there's certainly no journalist has gone back, had gone back for decades. And I realized that this was not only an incredible story, incredible in the true meaning of that word, but also a great window into the 70s, which were a decade very different than I had understood them, even though, you know, I was technically alive, but I was just a kid at the time.
Different in what way? In the violence?
Well, yeah. That you know, I always assumed that the 60s were the time of great tumult in America with assassinations and riots, and that, you know, somehow the country kind of chilled out in the 70s. And I could not have been more wrong. The amount of violence, especially political in nature, 1,000 bombings a year. Think about that. 1,000 political bombings a year in the United States in the early and mid-70s. And Watergate and the energy crisis and 2 hijackings a month of airplanes. I mean, the level of chaos and violence was just extraordinary. And the Symbionese Liberation Army, while certainly exotic, was very much of a part of the craziness that was going on in the country.
As I was reading the book, I realized that I felt very self-conscious by the fact that I didn't know what Symbionese meant. I didn't know what the Symbionese Liberation Army was other than in context to this story. And then, as you tell in the book, well, they just made it up.
That's right. I mean, it's funny how many people think there was some country named Symbionese or something. I mean, there is Donald DeFries, who was the escaped prisoner, who was the leader of the SLA, made up the word as sort of an adjective of symbiosis, the process of coming together. And as I know, you know, they didn't liberate anything or anyone,
right.
And they called themselves an army, though at most they had a dozen people. So the name was sort of triply misleading, but it is widely remembered, just because it's so exotic and weird.
You spoke of the bombings a moment ago, but this also is a time where the country was reeling. You had Watergate, you had the energy crisis, you had Vietnam still in its last stages. And this was a country that was in a lot of turmoil and splitting in many different ways.
And that was the great surprise to me. Richard Nixon didn't end the Vietnam War, but he did end the draft. And with the end of the draft in the early 70s, you had a melting away of many of the middle-class kids who formed the basis of the anti-war movement. And what was left, especially in the Bay Area, was really an angry fringe. And the SLA, which was not, though a lot of people remember it this way, a black nationalist group. There was only one African American in it, DeFries himself, who called himself General Field Marshal Sinque. The people who were involved were angry and damaged and violent and saw themselves as not heirs to the free speech movement or the Summer of Love, idealistic parts of the American counterculture. They saw themselves as heirs to the Red Brigades in Italy, the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany, most especially the Tupamaros in Uruguay, who were terrorists intent on bringing their societies down.
One of the things that I found so interesting in the book is why Patty Hearst, and you write about this, and of course she is, as the title suggests, an American heiress. But you also write about how vulnerable she was at this time, and I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit about that, of her vulnerabilities, where she was in her life, and really to open her up to such a capture and kidnapping.
Well, for starters, she was just 19 years old when she was kidnapped, and 19 is young.
Right.
And she was at a stage in her life where she was even more restless than most 19-year-olds. She was whipsawed between her fiancé, who she was living with, Stephen Weed, whom she was growing increasingly alienated from. She didn't like him. She was not looking forward to marrying him. And her mother, who she was fighting with in part about Stephen Weed. And she was at a particularly vulnerable moment, that she was very much isolated, both from her family and from her fiancé and her friends. So, yes, she was wealthy and had a famous last name, but she was a vulnerable kid and susceptible to the influences of the people around her. And after she was kidnapped on February 4th, 1974, the fact that several of the SLA people were actually kind of nice to her and talking to her and listening to her had a big impact on her.
Why her specifically, and ultimately, how did they find her?
The SLA was such a seat of the pants, often incompetent organization. Planning was not their long suit. What happened was the SLA had assassinated the school superintendent in Oakland, Marcus Foster, a horrible, terrible act that really alienated even the most radical parts of the counterculture. The Black Panthers, the Weather Underground, wanted no part of it. And two of their members were arrested. Just at that point, there was an influx of three people from the Indiana University Theater Program, not usually thought of as a hotbed of radicalism, but in fact, people who believed in guerrilla theater. And they thought, you know what, we got to get away from assassinations, but maybe we could do a kidnapping. And it was at just that moment that there was an engagement announcement in the San Francisco Examiner, the Hearst paper. Patricia Hearst was to be married to Stephen Weed. And in the fourth paragraph of that announcement, it said that Patricia was an undergraduate at the University of California at Berkeley. one of the SLA recruits, Emily Harris, knew that there was a big black binder that had the addresses of every Berkeley student, and it was open to the public in that more innocent age. And Bill Harris, her husband, went and looked Patricia up, and it said she lived at 2603 Benvenue, apartment number 4. So they started staking out her apartment. And it was really through that quirky series of circumstances that they decided to kidnap Patricia Hearst. They knew nothing about her other than that she was a student and that she was a Hearst.
She was 19 years old and vulnerable, and as you point out, this is the case with many of the kids in the SLA. They were young, they were vulnerable. What were they seeking in this group?
Well, that is a very fair question with not a clear answer, which tells you a lot about the SLA. I mean, mostly they were seeking publicity. To the extent they had a theory underlying their actions, it was something known as the FOCO theory, which was popular in radical circles, which was the idea that small revolutionary acts would lead to a broader uprising in the public. That was the theory, it was posited, underlying Fidel Castro's revolution, which they admired. So these, you know, revolutionary acts, they thought would inspire the public, and the SLA did, these very long, turgid communiques full of radical talk that basically made that point, that they were looking for a broader revolution. Of course, their actions had precisely the opposite impact. To the extent anyone read or paid attention to their motives, they grew more alienated from the leftist causes that the SLA espoused. The notion that the murder of Marcus Foster or the kidnapping of Patty Hearst would inspire the revolutionary proletariat was misguided, to say the least.
Jeffrey Toobin is a New Yorker staff writer and is the senior legal analyst for CNN. His new book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. So the members of the SLA, how were they exploited?
Well, I don't know if exploited is the right word. I mean, they volunteered to be exploited. They volunteered to be part of this revolutionary movement. At least in my judgment, Patty Hearst did join them. And everything they did was for a public relations goal. And they really did believe in you know, getting a lot of attention for themselves. So when they decided to rob a bank, the first thing they looked for was a bank with a relatively new technological innovation, the security camera, because they wanted to display their prize recruit, Patricia Hearst, in the course of the bank robbery. So they found a bank in the Sunset Section of San Francisco, the Hibernia Bank, and when they robbed it on April 15th, 1974, they put Patricia right in the middle of the bank where they knew she would be photographed by the cameras. And I think many people will probably remember the photographs of her carrying her machine gun in the bank. That led them to, you know, even greater public attention, if not public affection. And it also led to the fact that most of them were wiped out a month later.
The question that keeps on coming up in the context of the story and of the book is, was she brainwashed or radicalized? And is that an apt question for all of the members of the SLA?
I'm not sure those two concepts are precise opposites, but it is certainly a good question for all of them, which is just more broadly, why did they do what they did? And you know, that's the question that you know is at the heart of fiction and nonfiction, is like, why do people behave the way they do? And you know, it's my judgment about Patty Hearst that, you know, she was indeed kidnapped in a terribly violent act. You know, there had been conspiracy theorists that she staged her own kidnapping, which I completely reject. But it is the case, I think, that she, like these others in the SLA, like these other middle-class kids, did become radicalized. And she did become a voluntary participant in And this is something that I learned in the course of the book, writing the book, just an extraordinary number of crimes over a year and a half. It's not just the bank robbery of the Hibernia Bank. It's shooting up a street in Los Angeles. It's two other bank robberies, including one where a woman was killed. It's a series of bombings in Northern California. And it's a story about how Patricia Hearst had many opportunities simply to walk away from the SLA and return to her former life, and she never did. So it's my conclusion that she did eventually become a voluntary participant in the activities of the SLA.
There is the iconic photograph of Patricia Hearst standing with a machine gun in front of the SLA flag. This was taken shortly before the bank robbery on April 15th, 1974. It's one of the most iconic images of the 1970s. What do we learn from just looking at that photo?
Well, I think the photograph is a perfect metaphor for the case as a whole. And I write in the book, not facetiously, that it's a kind of Mona Lisa for the 1970s because Patricia's expression is so inscrutable. You can read what you want into her expression. You can see her as steely or terrified. You can see her as happy or sad, scared or proud. It is, even though it was taken in the spur of the moment by one of the other SLA members, Ms. Moon Soltysik, it is an extraordinary portrait. And I think the iconic nature of that portrait and the mystery at the heart of it is one reason why this case continues to resonate, because you can't tell what's going on in her head from the portrait. And it's compelling for just that reason.
A month later, May 16th, 1974, there's an incident. Two members of the SLA decide to go shopping. Patty Hearst is with them. They go into a sporting goods store. She waits, but she doesn't leave. Tell us a little bit about that incident and why it's so important in this story.
May 16th, 1974, the group has fled San Francisco for Los Angeles in light of the bank robbery. Nine of them crowd into a small house in South Central Los Angeles. They start to go stir crazy, and three of them, to relieve the boredom, decide to go shopping. Bill and Emily Harris and Patricia Hearst go out in a van, and they go to a grocery store, and they go to a newsstand, and then they go to buy some clothes at a place called Mel's Sporting Goods. Bill and Emily leave Patricia alone in the van across four lanes of traffic from Mel's. She can drive away. The key's in the ignition. She can walk away. She can call the police. She can call home. She can do anything she wants, but instead she stays. Inside Mel's Sporting Goods, Bill Harris, because he's a genius, decides to shoplift. And the clerk in the store is an aspiring police officer, Anthony Shepard. And Anthony knows that the crime of shoplifting does not take place until the person actually leaves the store. So he keeps an eye on Bill. And once he leaves the store, Anthony Shepard tackles Bill. Bill, Anthony, and then Emily Harris and bystanders, there's a melee in front of Mel's Sporting Goods with Patricia across the street watching. What does she do? She doesn't walk away, drive away. No. She gets a machine gun out of the back of the van, points it out the window, and fires repeatedly trying to free her friends. Miraculously, she doesn't hit anybody, but it doesn't work. Then she gets another machine gun, does the same thing, and this time it works, and Bill and Emily Harris are able to extricate themselves, jump into the van, and leave. This, to me, is the perfect symbol of how Patricia had become a member of the SLA. Given her opportunity for completely independent action, not only did she passively support the SLA, she committed this incredibly violent act, which miraculously didn't result in any injuries, but I think told you what was going on in Patricia's head at that moment.
In our final moments, let's talk a little bit about the trial, because this is a fascinating element of the book. You have, of course, in your past, written the main books about the O.J. Simpson case, and a key player in that case was F. Lee Bailey. Certainly F. Lee Bailey, a main character in this book as well. Why was he chosen by the Hearst family to defend Patty Hearst?
In 1975, when Patricia was arrested, F. Lee Bailey was the most famous lawyer in America, a swashbuckling defense attorney, basically created the modern idea of the high-profile defense attorney who used the press, who wrote books, who appeared on television. And so it was not surprising that the Hearsts reached out to him. It didn't work out so well.
When that idea of putting her on the stand, why did he not understand that that would go as badly as it did?
Because there was an underlying legal controversy. Bailey knew that the jury would feel sympathy for Patricia's experience being kidnapped because it was horrible. But the problem was she also had a lot of other things to explain, not just the bank robbery itself for which she was on trial, but her year and a half on the run, the other bank robberies that she participated in, the shootings that she participated in. And Bailey's terrible error was that he did not get a clear ruling from the judge about what the limits of the prosecutor's cross-examination would be. Bailey thought he could get the judge to say, we will not allow cross-examination of Hearst on these other crimes. But the judge, when push came to shove, allowed Jim Browning, who was the prosecutor, to ask Patricia questions about her other crimes while she was on the run. Bailey, in that circumstance, had no choice but to ask Patricia to take the fifth in front of the jury about all these other crimes. And once a defendant takes the fifth in front of the jury, you can really be sure that the jury is going to draw every adverse inference, which they are entitled to do under the law. And that really sealed the fate of her conviction.
You write in the book that F. Lee Bailey was really never able to completely rebound from that conviction. What about Patty Hearst? How did she rebound after being released from prison?
Patty Hearst is tough and a survivor. And I think that's one of the lessons I learned in writing this book. Patty Hearst, perhaps most remarkably of all, rebounded by becoming the woman she was intended to be. She became a wealthy socialite, a homemaker, a rich lady in the suburbs who had a few sort of exotic hobbies. She, you know, appeared in a couple of movies as an actress. She wrote a book. She wrote a mystery. But basically, Patty Hearst turned into the woman her mother wanted her to be. And that is, I think, you know, at one level surprising, but not all that surprising because, after all, isn't that what happens to all of us?
She chose not to cooperate, and I assume you tried very hard to get her to cooperate.
I did. And in fact, I can recount our one conversation in its entirety. After many emails and letters, I called her up and I said, "Hi, Patricia, this is Jeff Toobin." And she said, "Oh, God," then click. So I think I got the message that this was not going to be an opportunity for her. She would not take the opportunity to participate in the writing of the book.
How do you think the book would have been different had she participated?
You know, that's a good question. I guess I can't know. I mean, the good news is I really did have her perspective on these events. She'd written a book. She testified many times. She'd given other interviews. So it wasn't like I had to guess about what she thought. You know, I don't blame her in some ways. She's in her early 60s. She's a mother. She's a grandmother. She's a widow. She doesn't want to revisit these things. That I can certainly respect. The other part is, you know, she has given a lot of interviews almost exclusively to people who don't know a lot about the case. And so she hasn't faced really close questioning about things like why she shot up Mel Sporting Goods. And in that respect, I can certainly understand her decision as well.
Jeffrey Toobin's new book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. It is published by Doubleday. Jeffrey Toobin, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thanks, Joe.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org or subscribe to our podcast. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.